And now, the life and sometimes controversial work of Stanley Milgram. In the 1960s, on the campus of Yale University, Milgram conducted what he called obedience experiments. He deceived subjects into thinking they were conducting a psychology experiment, but in fact, they were the ones being studied. The idea was to see if they would administer a painful and potentially dangerous electric shock to someone simply because Milgram or one of his confederates told them to. That's just one of Stanley Milgram's famous or infamous experiments. He went on to develop something called the lost letter theory and the small world concept, which later became known as 6 degrees of separation. Well, joining me now to talk more about Stanley Milgram is my guest, Thomas Blass. He is a professor of psychology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He's also the author of The Man Who Shocked the World, The Life and Legacy of Stanley Milgram. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And I remind listeners that if they'd like to join this conversation, our number is 1-800-989-8255. Now, Dr. Blass, I want to step through this experiment, the obedience experiment, because mm-hmm. I want to make sure I've got it right and that our listeners understood what happened.
Sure.
So a subject would come in to the lab, and Stanley Milgram, not really, but there would be two people in the lab, both of whom were Confederates of
right.
Stanley Milgram, although the subject didn't know that. And the idea was one of the Confederates was in charge of the experiment,
mm-hmm.
and he would offer them a choice, but it wasn't really a choice, of being the teacher or the learner.
Right.
And it was rigged so that the subject, this is the naive person, would be the teacher.
Exactly. The other person was apparently supposedly sitting there already. He's supposedly a subject, but he's also in cahoots with Milgram. So one person, as you say, he was the experimenter. The other person was a Confederate, but by rigged drawing, naive subject always became the teacher,
right.
the Confederate the learner.
So here's the teacher. So the guy who's in charge of the experiment says to the teacher, here's what you do. You're going to read a list of words to this word pairs to this subject, and then you're going to test him to see whether he gets the pairs correctly.
Right.
And if you get them correctly, you get to the next one. And if you get them wrong, you administer a shock.
Right.
And if it gets wrong a second time, then it's a stronger shock and so on. The idea, again, the idea in this bogus experiment was to say, you know, maybe punishment is an effective tool for helping people to learn.
Right. That was the cover story.
That's the cover story. But
right.
but so the naive subject, he's in there. And what the experiment in the end showed was that the Confederate of Stanley Milgram, who is in charge of the experiment, is saying to the teacher, okay, administer the shock. And the teacher is saying, but I might be hurting him. He says, no, you have to do it. It's important. This is crucial for the experiment to be done properly. You have to administer the shock, right?
Right, more or less. Yeah, there was a set of prods. I mean, you captured the essence of it. A set of prods, which he used whenever there was hesitation. And when those prods would be exhausted and the person still refused to go on, at that point he would be declared defiant. If he did continue and all the way to the end, then being 450 volts apparently, but not really, he would be an obedient. That would be means that he's obedient, basically.
Right.
Fully obedient.
Right. And so just we're going to have to take a break in a minute, but in the general sense, what was the remarkable finding here that Milgram came across?
Well, roughly two-thirds of the people were willing to go step by step to the end, to the maximum shock of 450 volts, which not only numerically was a designated, but there were verbal labels like mild shock, moderates, intense shock, very high intensity shock, and finally XXX beyond words.
So, right. So even though the subjects who were the teacher in the experiment, even though they knew they were administering a shock that could be dangerous or painful for certain, they went ahead and did it because the person who was, you know, they're in charge of the experiment was saying, you have to do this because, you know, this is how the experiment is designed.
Well, right, exactly. But the mediating factor is that they accepted his right to tell them what to do.
Right.
But exactly, that's what they did.
Okay. So we're going to explore that, and we're going to also explore what it means in today's world and why those experiments are hard to replicate in today's world. But right now we have to take a short break, so stay with us. This is Science Friday from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. We're talking this hour about the psychologist Stanley Milgram with my guest Thomas Blass, author of The Man Who Shocked the World, The Life and Legacy of Stanley Milgram. And we'd like to hear from you at 1-800-989-8255. So what was the conclusion? Why were people stunned by this result in 1962, 1963 when the tests were done?
It goes against our self-image. I think most people don't think that they'd be willing to give very dangerous, perhaps harmful shocks to an innocent victim who did nothing to deserve it, and plus that there is no coercive factor involved. In other words, the experimenter had no coercive means to enforce his commands. Sometimes people, when they sort of generalize some of the experiment to other situations, forget that. That's, I think, one of the telling parts of his research, that the gray lab-coated experimenter had nothing but the aura of scientific authority and his commands coming from him that got people to go along with his commands. We don't need to know that somebody holds a gun to your head that you're going to go along with things that you would normally not do, but that's not what Milgram's experiment showed us. Even without coercion, and even when the person is innocent, people are willing to follow the orders of an authority who they feel has the right to tell them what to do.
And yes, that's the bigger
question.
And
across moral line. I mean, obviously, they're doing something they would not do on their own. Normally, we think that the kind of person we are, what we do, flows directly from the kind of people we are. You know, if we're good moral people, we act in a good moral fashion. If we're nasty people, we behave in a nasty fashion. But I think more generally, what Milgram showed is that factors that we often overlook, the momentary situational characteristics surrounding the individual, in this case, the force of the authority, can make us override our conscience, make us step outside of our moral boundaries and do things we would not do when we're doing things under our own steam.
Now, just to make it clear here, I may not have made this clear when I was describing the experiment, there was no actual shock delivered.
That is correct.
The subject thought he was, or she in most cases, he thought he was delivering a shock, but the person in the room in some iterations of the experiment, the person in the room would say, "Ouch, stop, that's hurting me."
It was a prepared...
But it was an acting job.
It was acting. Actually, it was a prepared tape to standardize the shock, the responses, which became more intense and pitiful as the person went up the shock board, the shock generator.
Right. Well, let's take a call now. Our number is 800-989-8255 and go to Peter in South Carolina. You're on the air, Peter.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good.
Okay.
Well, I was part of one of these experiments back in 1972, and I was a freshman at the University of South Carolina, and they just tended to call people randomly, and they said, "Hey, you want to participate in a psychology experiment?" And I said, "Sure." I mean, I was kind of game then, and to this day, I still answer surveys and stuff like that. So I haven't changed very much, but they had a little bit of a different take on it, I guess, in 72 versus 62, because they had a guy in a white lab coat, and the two of us there.
Yeah.
And they shocked both of us. Well, they shocked me, I guess.
What, continually
shock,
or just once?
Yeah, just let me know, what this guy was going to go through. Well, of course, I was the one that was going to administer the test.
Right. Milgram did the same thing. He gave a sample shock to the teacher subject to the credibility. In fact, that's the only shock that ever occurred in the experiment, the sample shock to the teacher. Sounds like what you went through was very similar.
Right. And then the other guy was in another room, but the thing about it is the guy in the lab coat was not in the same room with me. Mm-hmm. They just let me kind of go through the seat. And what they were doing is they were doing a sequence of numbers.
Right.
And if the guy got it wrong, then I was supposed to hit the zap button.
Mm-hmm.
And as
so he was not
worse and worse. This guy was screaming in the other room and kicking stuff, and I'm going like I'm freaking out.
But did you continue to administer shocks?
No, I stopped.
Okay.
I told him I wasn't going to do it. But the guy in the lab coat was in another room. He wasn't there while I was doing it.
And he kept saying to you, "You're supposed to continue."
No. The thing is, I remember he was not there and did not do that. I just stopped on my own, and then I did the call button. They said, did you finish the sequence?
How far did you go? Can I ask?
And I said, no, I'm not going to finish the sequence.
You didn't finish. Well, that sounds, you know, I wasn't there, so I'm not even familiar. I try to keep up with all the replications. I'm not, you know who ran it? Who the supervising experimenter?
Oh, gosh. I mean, like, you know, 35 years ago
yeah.
All the stuff I did in college. Yeah, right.
What I want to say is that there were many different variations. Milgram himself conducted an experiment in which the experimenter actually communicated with the teacher's subject by phone. He wanted to see what variations in the situational features of the immediate situation create in the amount of obedience. And it sounds to me like, I don't know whether you may have been in one of a number of different variations that this experiment had built into it.
The guy in the lab coat was another room, but,
mm-hmm. but I'm
another situation happened to me 2 years later at the same university when I was in the psychology course.
Yeah.
And they were doing a biofeedback experiment where they wanted to see if people could regulate their heartbeat by thinking about it, and you were supposed to deliver a shock.
Right.
Well, you know, I was really interested in biofeedback, and when they told me what was going on, I figured that one out.
Peter, I think
I ruined their whole experiment.
Peter, I want to focus on a part of what you were saying. You said just a minute ago that you were freaking out because of this requirement to make this other person feel pain.
Absolutely.
When they told you, oh, well, listen, we weren't really giving him a shock. You know, this was an experiment to see how you would behave. Did you feel, I mean, what did that make you feel like?
Well, you know, I was like the quintessential, you know, 112-pound weakling at that point and felt like a real, you know, just made a fool of.
Mm-hmm.
I was very, very small and, you know, and just had not really matured yet because I actually grew a few inches and gained a lot of weight in my first 2 years of college.
Well,
felt humiliated.
Right. Let me turn to Dr. Blass then and say this is why some people felt that Dr. Milgram's experiments doing this sort of thing were abusive in a sense because they were causing stress and pain to the person who was in the experiment.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Well, that is one of the main criticisms, the ethical criticism. But I should mention that your reaction of feeling foolish certainly is one of a number of possible reactions, and I've heard other people say the same thing. On the other hand, some people learn something about themselves and use this as a lesson for future behavior. The readiness with which they gave in to essentially moral orders. And some people, having learned about it or even participated in the experiment, have been able to fend off in future situations and thinking back on the experiment, fend off unwanted pressures by virtue of their experience. So I don't, you know, what you're telling me is I've heard from others, but I've also heard the positive side.
Well, I've always been the one that spoke up for the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I'm not sure if it's just because of the way I was brought up, but I've always been that way. And frankly, it's gotten me in trouble a lot of times with corporate America.
Okay. Hey, Peter, thanks very much for sharing that experience with us. Let me ask you, Dr. Blass, what was, you know, so these experiments were conducted in the 60s mm-hmm. when the World War II was still a pretty fresh memory and certainly the Holocaust. How did people use this in terms of understanding the behavior of some of the Nazi soldiers in the Holocaust?
Well, Milgram, one of the things that stimulated him to conduct the experiment was to shed some new light on the Holocaust. And he felt that you don't have to, what it teaches is that you don't have to be a monster to act in a monstrous fashion. It's hard to say that, you know, in Germany, although maybe a million people were involved in actual direct killings and you had 60 million people just standing by, you can't say that all of them were sadists or crazy. What he's saying is that even normal people without any hate toward their victims can be caught up in a destructive process. The thing is, though, that I don't agree with that, actually. I don't agree with that fully because to say that there was no hatred is really not applicable to what happened in Nazi Germany.
Hmm.
Clearly, the Nazi Germany and their Nazis and their allies were full of hatred toward the Jews. So, in my judgment, Milgram's model applies only to part of the Holocaust, the part where you have, let's say, a train man, you know, conductor, instead of taking apples from Bremerhaven to Munich, is shipping 5,000 Jews with the same degree of routinization to Auschwitz. That maybe the Milgram model.
Right.
It doesn't account how the Milgram model doesn't fit the vicious, inventive cruelties of the Nazi guards who tried to outdo each other in coming up with the most vicious treatment, degrading, even before they killed them.
Right. So it's a partial explanation.
In my judgment, yes.
Yeah. Let's go for another call now and hear from Hugh in Ohio. You're on the air, Hugh.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have to tell you, this is the best show of the week for me. I work my tail off to get from Pittsburgh so I can listen to this on my way back to Michigan.
Okay.
So
that's nice.
I just want to say that this is a great, great show. I actually dealt with a lot of the issues that I was asking about, because it seems to me that as one of the or as a teacher, you would be subjected to this idea that now all of a sudden you will do anything if somebody tells you to do it. And I guess I heard that some of the people that were in that position were affected significantly by it. And I just want to say that that makes sense to me. It seems to me that the victim wasn't the person that was supposed to get the shock.
Yeah,
and he didn't.
The victim was the person who was administering the shock.
Exactly so.
Well,
Hugh, that's
yes and no, because he had always had the choice of getting up and walking out the door, and which, in fact, one-third of the subjects made that choice. Nobody tied their hands. Obviously, the pressures were difficult to counteract, and it's clearly a surprise that two-thirds of the people were willing to go along, you know, stop and go, but end up with a full maximum shock. But ultimately, they had a choice. And so to use the word victim, I think, is sort of too strong to describe the teacher subject.
Let's take another call now and go to Josh. Josh in Athens, Ohio. Welcome to Science Friday. You're on the air.
Thanks. That's actually funny. I actually just came back from Pittsburgh myself.
Well, we have a nexus here. I don't understand.
Yeah. So I guess my question is, when I was in school, I remember in Psychology 101 learning about these experiments, and as part of our class, you had to go be a part of an experiment for your grade. And I remember one of the things that made me feel as I was in the experiment was I was trying to figure out what the ulterior motive or goal was of the experimenter. It seems like today the public's much more suspicious. They're waiting for kind of the shock ending, trying to figure out what the real narrative of the experiment is. And so I just wanted to ask, how do scientists and people doing experiments deal with that? How do you do experiments of this nature when you have kind of that built-in suspicion, that built-in, you know, questioning, like what's really going on here?
Yeah.
That could mean what's really, you know, trying to be achieved.
Good question, Josh.
Yeah, well, that was actually a problem in Milgram's time, too. A small proportion did not believe in the cover story, did not believe, although he went to great lengths to build in credibility. He was almost like a stage manager. Every hair was in place, to so to speak, to make sure that it looked very authentic. The shock machine was just a beautiful-looking, professional-looking shock machine, and the voice feedback, etc. It was all minutely thought out. But in spite of that, a small proportion did see through the deception. It is a constant problem, and I don't think it has to do with. I don't think it has changed with time, in my judgment. And to the extent that that's a problem, there's ways of weeding it out. Not 100%. Sure, for sure, but there's what's called a debriefing, which is almost mandatory, certainly mandatory laboratory experiments today because of ethical guidelines, where you tell if there is misinformation, or even if there isn't, you reveal the full purpose of the experiment. During that time, or even before, during that time, often there's a probe for, you know, kind of gradually, what do you think the experiment was about? And sometimes subjects will reveal that they guessed what it was about.
Right.
So what you're saying is right on target. But generally speaking, the ways of dealing with it, not 100%, securely, but it is. Experimentalists, social psychologists are aware of that as a potential problem.
Yeah, we're talking with Thomas Blass, author of The Man Who Shocked the World, The Life and Legacy of Stanley Milgram. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Science Friday from NPR News. And Dr. Blass, I have to tell you one little bit of interesting trivia that I learned from your book. So Dr. Milgram, when he left Yale, he came to the City University of New York.
And he went to Harvard.
Harvard briefly, Harvard, that's right. And then he came to City University of New York.
Right.
And his office was at 33 West 42nd Street in Manhattan. I'm speaking to you today from 11 West 42nd Street, which is the building right next door to Dr. Milgram's office. I went in there just this morning, and it's the it's now the optometry school for the State University of New York. But it's just weird that we're in
It is weird, and in fact, your producer actually alerted me to that, which is amazing. I was in that building when it was still the Graduate Center. I'm not sure why they moved from there, because it was a terrific place. It was a lot of thought went into, not by Milgram, but by the person in charge. You know, a lot of thought went into the construction and the interior and everything. So I'm not sure why they moved, but it's amazing that you're right next door.
Yeah, it is. I mention it because it raises an interesting question. So here's Dr. Stanley Milgram, does these remarkable experiments at Yale, gets hired at Harvard for a few years, and then he doesn't stay at Harvard, and he's controversial. And instead of going to a major U.S. university, he winds up at the City University of New York. Nothing, a knock on that university, a lot of good people there, but it wasn't the top school in the country at the time. Well, was that because of the controversial nature of his work?
Exactly. Milgram came to realize, sadly, that he was much too controversial to actually wanted to be at a top university. He was hoping when he, finished at Yale, he would go to the University of Chicago, Berkeley. He didn't want to be in a small town. Cornell, there was something of an offer from Cornell, but he didn't want to be stuck in a small town. He wanted to do, because he had planned to do urban research. But, there was a major disappointment, but he came to recognize the reality that in any department where, you vote, departments typically vote on candidates, there's no way that he would get a majority. He recognized the ongoing controversial nature of his work. So he resigned himself to it, as it turns out. And in fact, he was hoping that he wouldn't have to stay at CUNY maybe 5 years. There was correspondence with some of his colleagues about one of his colleagues, Roger Brown, wanted to bring him back to Harvard. But he soon came to realize that actually was a blessing in disguise, because he did a lot of interesting things there.
Dr. Blass, we have to take a short break. We'll come back to this discussion. And when we come back from the break, we'll talk with Dr. Blass. But we also want to know why you think there are fingerprints. Call us 800-989-8255 with your theory. This is Science Friday from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. We're talking this hour about the psychologist Stanley Milgram with my guest Thomas Blass. He's the author of the book The Man Who Shocked the World, The Life and Legacy of Stanley Milgram. And in a few minutes, we're going to be talking about fingerprints. And I've thrown out a challenge. I want people to call and say in one sentence, if they can, what their theory is about why we have fingerprints and what they're good for. And then we'll see if our expert in this case can set us straight. That number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. But Dr. Blass, before we say goodbye to you, I wanted you to point out at least one of the Dr. Milgram is, Stanley Milgram, totally famous for the obedience experiment, but I don't think as many people are aware of the fact that this notion of 6 degrees of separation or the small world was something that he had thought about in his professional career and actually done things to demonstrate.
Exactly. In fact, it's probably nothing will ever exceed the obedience experiment as being his most important work, but sort of creeping up there is the 6 degrees of separation. Actually, he called it the small world problem.
And how does that work?
It works. What he did was he had a bunch of so-called starters. People send letters from Omaha, Nebraska, to someone whom they did not know in Sharon, Massachusetts. And the idea was to send this mailing on to somebody that they knew who was more likely to move it forward in the right direction. He found, and where the phrase comes from, 6 degrees of separation, is that of the chains that were completed, and they were not all completed, but those that were completed, it took roughly six connections to reach a stranger, a total stranger at the other end of the United States. So it is important because it turns out that Milgram, although he was focusing only on social networks, which in itself was a surprise. If he asked people beforehand, how many people do you think you know, people estimate like 50. So the fact that you have a short path connecting people in a large social network is itself a revelation. But I think the reason it's important now is that he inadvertently identified something about our physical world more generally, because there are people, applied mathematicians, computer scientists, people like Steve Strogatz and Duncan Watts, mm-hmm. have applied it, have shown that the same principle applies to the electric grid in the western United States, to the neurons of animals, the brain function. So although the point is that this rule, a short path connecting huge networks, seems to be a broader rule than simply social networks, and which is why you have Steve Strogatz called it a renaissance in that of the small world problem. So,
okay. Well, Dr. Blass, thank you. I mean, I encourage people who want to learn more about this remarkable man to read your book, because it is replete with instances of his insight and his quirkiness, and
right.
quite of a funny guy in some ways.
He was.
But anyway, we have to leave things there. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thomas Blass is a professor of psychology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He's the author of The Man Who Shocked the World, The Life and Legacy of Stanley Milgram.